Have you ever wondered why certain stories seem to refuse to die on the internet? You know, the ones that keep on being forwarded to you, like the video of the cat who played the piano. Bill Wasik, who's a senior editor at Harper's, can explain because he's the creator of one of the more infamous social experiments on the internet. And he is also the author of And Then There's This, How Stories Live and Die in Viral Culture, which is published by Viking. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
What led to your interest in this topic, especially the experiment that involved a flash mob?
Well, that was the experiment that got me interested in the whole thing. In 2003, just as a sort of prank slash experiment, I sent out an email to a number of friends trying to gather an inexplicable mob of people for 10 minutes or less in New York. And I figured that this might become a little New York fad, that I might do a few of them over the summer. What I didn't expect was that very soon after I did a successful what came to be known as a flash mob, that soon they started happening in San Francisco and in Minneapolis, and then soon all around the world. And so I found myself wondering, how do these kinds of things spread?
You're the guy who did this?
Well, you know.
Out of this room.
Did you
coin the phrase flash mob?
No, I didn't actually. Somebody, an observer of the events that I and then soon other people were doing, gave it that name. The interesting thing was that on some level I didn't do it because, with all of these viral phenomena, it's all the people who forward it along who really do it. And so to a certain extent, as the creator, you feel very good about yourself. But then you realize that it takes thousands of individual acts of people taking it on as their own for it to actually spread.
So the randomness is in that other people send it out because you're sending it to a select group, people you know. This is like inviting people to a party. And then how many people wind up being invited who you have no idea?
Well, you never really know. I mean, in the case of the flash mobs, if of the original 60 people I sent the email to, probably only a handful ever actually came to one of the events. And so you figure that in order to get many hundreds of people, which is what the events were getting at their peak, you figure that probably it's going out to untold thousands of people.
You have to wonder why somebody who receives an email saying we're going to all get together at a certain place would even show up.
Well, the email actually addressed that question, and it said very shamefacedly that the reason that you should come is that lots of other people were going to come too, and that was sort of playing on the kind of sardonic sort of herd behavior aspect of the experiment. That people. People want to come places because they know that other people will be there too, and that's part of what's going on the internet writ large.
And it worked.
No, yeah, it worked in my case, but it also worked well beyond what I ever expected, and so I became very interested in this viral phenomenon in a greater sense.
Did you keep on refining the message?
No, the message pretty much stayed the same.
But some did better than others. Was it because people started hearing about these things?
Well, yeah, I think that what happened over time was they started to become a little fad, and so people would find out about them not just through the email, but there's a radio spot about it, or there's a TV thing, or I read on a blog about it, and so a lot of what I'm interested in the book is not just the way that these things spread, but the way that they tend to – there tends to be such a hullabaloo around them that they reach this fevered peak and then they die out because they can't bear up under all the excitement that's thrown at them.
Well, you're a member of the old media, but the old media really helps disseminate this kind of thing in the new media.
Yeah, the way I don't see it as an opposition between the old media and the new media, especially today where, you look at old news organizations like the New York Times, which at this point are some of the most sophisticated users of the new media out there. I think that the two sort of have joined together in a giant old new media blob, and they are collaborating at sort of finding and spreading novelty, and we're all the beneficiaries of that.
You said that initially you wanted to remain anonymous. And then you wound up giving interviews.
Well, yeah, I gave them anonymously at first. My hope was that being anonymous would help that particular project spread because people wouldn't feel like that they're being hijacked by, some specific nefarious person for some terrible end. one reason why I feel like a lot of this viral marketing that people are supposedly doing online isn't very effective is that people don't want to be shills. They don't want to be dupes. They don't want to feel like that they're forwarding something along to advance somebody else's ends. They wanted to do it because it seems fun. And so I thought anonymity would help with that.
Well, viral marketing, when it's something like a politician, it worked well during the last presidential campaign, but it doesn't work well in selling products?
Well, I think with presidential candidates, I think that people don't feel like that they're shilling a product. They feel like, you know, that they've been convinced that they believe in somebody.
Right. And so they don't have to forward it if they don't support that candidate.
Right. And even with viral marketing, you find successful messages spread, but it tends to be in the category of a piece of entertainment that was created by a company that's sort of enjoyable in and of itself. And the fact that it's trying to hawk a product is really subsidiary.
Well, actually, with something like Snakes on a Plane, which I think was marketed that way, became a media sensation, then bombed at the box office.
Well, right.
It can be a success as some kind of a marketing thing or an internet thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to wind up being a success the way that people originally hoped it would.
No, and you know, a more extreme case of this is you sometimes see viral marketing ad companies using viral ads to try to sell cars. You know, so a little funny spot forwarded around to sell you a car. Well, you know, as Snakes on a Plane proved, viral attention often isn't enough to get people to plunk down $11 on a movie ticket. And the idea that they're going to plunk down, you know, $20,000 for a giant piece of metal that they put their kids in, you know, there's a disconnect there between what the viral medium can do, or at least the way that what it tends to do, and what a lot of people think that it can do.
Since you're an editor at Harper's, you must have known that the media just loves stories like this, at least at first. Did they turn on you at a certain point?
Well, I mean, what tends to, in the case of the flash mob, yes, there was a backlash, which the New York Times actually ran a backlash story, in my opinion, before there was actually a backlash. But I think
Times is always ahead of the news.
Right. But more often what happens is people just move along to the next thing. You know, the book that I wrote on some level is about, you know, you can think of it as being about Susan Boyle, even though, of course, it was published long before and her name doesn't appear anywhere in it. Susan Boyle, of course, being this woman in Britain who was this overnight sensation on Britain's Got Talent. And, you know, so she gets millions and millions of views. But it isn't just the popularity. It's the fact that then there's all this analysis, not just by the professional news media, but by amateurs. You have all these blog posts about how she represents the, you know, the obsession with youth and beauty, and maybe we're overcoming that. And there's she's a symbol of all these different things. But of course, there's just not enough to sustain that. And so, you know, inevitably it dies out.
And she lost.
Well, that's right. But I think even before she lost, there was a sense that all the oxygen had been sort of burned out of her fame.
My guest is Bill Wasik, who's written And Then There's This, How Stories Live and Die in Viral Culture. It's published by Viking. Well, you mentioned professional and amateur, and you say these debates tend to always boil down to the merits of amateurism. How would you define an amateur in the case of this sort of thing, the internet especially?
I think that it's a lot of people have a very mistaken notion about what exactly amateurism is on the internet. And here I'm talking
about, but anybody can have a blog.
Well, of course. But I mean, what I find is that the people who are winning audiences online tend to be people who, you know, yes, they are amateurs because they haven't made their money as a writer or somebody who makes culture, but they tend to be people who go into it with a real seriousness of purpose, you know. And, you know, this is something I think you can trace back to the education system that we have here, where, you know, people are encouraged for 20-some years of their life to follow their dreams and follow their hearts and, you know, study the liberal arts and maybe go get some actual training in radio or television or writing or visual arts. And then at a certain point around the time you're 25, suddenly the system says to you, you know what, here's a law school application or, you know, a business school or go off and do something where creativity isn't part of the equation. I think that a lot of the people who are doing work online, they're amateurs in the sense that They're people who, at one point in their lives, at one point in their adulthoods, you know, in their 20s, they were very seriously thinking about the kinds of stuff that they're engaging with. And then, so, you know, there's a level of sophistication there that's not just, you know, a somebody out there, you know, living off the grid who somehow found an internet connection and is typing up a blog.
Well, I've had a number of conversations with people who are predicting that newspapers and magazines are largely destined to disappear, and that we should just learn to live with this, and that the future will be the sort of thing we're getting on the internet. The argument against it, of course, is that the bloggers and Twitters don't have the resources or the time to dedicate to big stories, and professionals will know things that amateurs don't know. But that's where we're going to be getting our news in the future.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that I think that, things look a little bit grim for the newspapers, because
what are we going to do without foreign bureaus?
Well, I mean,
they're all folding them up.
But the problem is that, you know, from the consumer's point of view, when they buy the newspaper, they're not paying for the foreign bureaus. And the problem is that when you actually isolate it down to the people who really want to pay for the foreign bureaus, I'm not sure there's enough money there to support the foreign bureaus. You know, I think, though, that we will always have journalism, you know, that we will have bloggers and, you know, who are doing real investigative journalism. It's true that most of what's out there is parasitic, in the sense that it's just commentary and just bringing in stuff that other people have created. But there are great bloggers out there doing work in all kinds of different disciplines. And I think we'll always have that. What we won't always have is this very authoritative, you know, central source, as your you know, big city newspaper is, that, you know, says not just here's what I learned, but it carries the imprimatur of this large old institution.
Two words appear a lot in this book: mem and nanostory.
Meme. It's back
meme. I'm sorry. Well, I'm from the old school that didn't like mimes. What does meme mean? I've always wondered.
So the word meme was coined in the late 70s by Richard Dawkins, the famous British biologist, as part of his book The Selfish Gene. You know, which is if you've never read it, it's a wonderful book, and it's an incredible sort of short and lucid piece about how, or a book about how, you know, about the gene and how genetics work and et cetera. Later in the book, he hypothesizes that we might actually think of cultural replication as happening in the same way that genetic replication happens. So meme is designed to be a parallel to gene, although in that very book, he also says, well, virus is an equally good metaphor there. And so arguably, the idea of culture as a virus, well, it dates back at least to the late 70s with Richard Dawkins. Nanostory is a word that I coined in the book to describe stuff like Susan Boyle, the idea of these tiny little stories that flicker through the media, not just the new media, but the old media, sort of the two of them combined, that serve as the kind of basic unit of cultural conversation today. You know, so the there's also the example, say, of the AIG bonuses, where within this larger story of the financial crisis, we have to seize on these tiny little intense stories that we, you know, debate about six ways to Sunday. And we, you know, again, not just the traditional mainstream media, but the amateurs as well. And so that's sort of what I mean by a nanostory. And the two terms are definitely related, but slightly different.
As a talk show host, I'm very aware of the nanostories because I'm bombarded with suggestions that I book some guest to come on and talk about whatever they consider the latest story to be, usually somebody who I would never in a million years dream of having on the show.
And by the time they show up, the story's over. So,
in 2006, Time magazine declared its person of the year to be you, meaning all of us. Is that part of what we're talking about here?
Well, you know, on some level, that was just a sort of laughable thing, the idea that, well, all of us are the person of the year. Well, then, you know, what the idea of the person of the year has no meaning. And I do feel like that, you know, Time's idea about who is doing stuff online seemed a little off to me, because they seem to lean on this very homespun notion of what an amateur is. Even as all the examples that they gave, you know, like the kid who went out and taped George Allen's, Senator George Allen's famous macaca moment on the campaign trail. Well, you know, that kid was, I can't remember whether he was paid or unpaid, but he was an intern or a low-level staffer at the opposition campaign, and he was training his camera on Allen precisely to catch those kinds of moments.
And lucky for him, George Allen said something that stupid.
That's right. Well, but he would have been there. You know, he was just waiting for his moment, and the moment came, and so he seized it. And this, I feel like, is the more typical pattern online. You know, to me, I almost think of the internet as being like New York, in the sense where you used to come to New York for your big break. Now you go to the internet for your big break.
Well, we are seeing major differences. The Chinese government now wants to control what can be disseminated on the internet, and I think they want to eliminate Google as something that would be available to the Chinese people. We saw it in Iran, all of the various protests and the tweets that kept people informed in Iran of the story.
No, sir, and for all of my skepticism about exactly what this new media environment has brought to the American discourse and to American politics, of course, you have to look to less developed places and places with less of a tradition of freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, and take your hat off to what these technologies are doing in those cultures. You know, they are allowing people who want to express themselves and want to gather in ways that are outlawed by the government, and they're able to use them to get around central agencies of repression. And so it's certainly it isn't an issue of these tools being bad. It's an issue of how they're being used.
What about the people who say, well, this has no effect on me, I don't even have email?
Well, those people, I think, are getting fewer and fewer. But I think that it affects all of us, in the sense that if you're an old media consumer, a lot of their sense of, you know, where the new groundswells are coming from in politics, or where the interesting bands are coming from, you know, all of the stuff that they're reporting on is coming from online.
Bill Wasik will be giving a talk and speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca at 97 Warren Street. His book, And Then There Is This, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.